This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Back of the Nest, The Palace Years. We'll be covering the 16-17 season. That's the season where Pardew got sacked and Allardyce did the unthinkable, kept us up, and we ended up 14th. We'll be back with a full discussion of that season after this.
Back of the Nest, The Palace Years.
And there it is, that's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van, unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. So the only thing left to say is, you in. Order now on the McDonald's app. You can also get reward points delivered too. So the ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus. Rewards registration required. Points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
So joining me for this one is Mr. Hambling. How you doing?
Hello. I'm marvellous. Thank you very much.
Good, good. Patrick, how you doing?
Fantastic, thank you for asking.
Excellent. And Christopher, a bit hungover.
Yeah, but apart from that, looking forward to the show.
Good. He said he was green this morning, so we shall excuse him if he's a bit slow on the replies. A couple of things from last episode. Because we covered the final and we were all pretty riled up and kind of the volume rose in our voice and we all went off for a drink afterwards. We forgot to cover people's comments in Twitter. So apologies. We do read absolutely everyone. We talk about it before the show and everything like that. So apologies for those people who took the effort to message in. Please keep doing it. We've got some lovely ones for this episode. So as usual with these things now, you've probably, if you've been listening to the rest, you've probably got your head around it. We talk about the ins and outs for the season, first of all. And the transfer window 2016 was a particularly productive one. And if we compare it to some others, perhaps more recent ones, it seems like a distant memory. So, gentlemen, let's discuss, first of all, Steve Mandanda from Marseille. That was something that didn't quite work out, but the time seemed absolutely amazing.
Yeah, came with an absolutely huge reputation. I've been, I think, player of the season in France 2 years in a row. Was obviously pushing Hugo Lloris for the top spot in the French national team. We'd been looking for a new number one. Obviously, in the last episode, we talked about the fact we looked in the direction of Alex McCarthy and he was quite harshly treated. This time, we tried to replace Wayne Hennessy with what looked like a surefire 100% hit of a footballer. But I just wonder, honestly, what happened. I mean, the motivation seemed to be to get Steve Mandanda in because he was able to play with the ball at his feet and Pardew had it in his head that he was going to impart this new style of football onto the team. And that was what was talked about in the summer. And he obviously started the season in goal, but quite rapidly fell out of favour and then sort of left the country and essentially didn't come back. It was a bizarre way. I don't really understand what happened. It seemed to come across like he didn't really want the move in the first place, didn't settle, didn't like the culture. His family stayed in France. It was talked about that he had some family issues and had to go back, but it was pretty clear he had no intention of playing for Crystal Palace after a period of time. Hugely disappointing.
And yeah, it was a shame. I mean, he got the lovely Steve calls and people were willing to embrace him, but I think it did seem like a slightly extravagant purchase, not in the amount of money because it was only $1.5 million, but it wasn't something that anyone was necessarily too bothered about at the time, other than the odds early Hennessy hater.
I loved the move at the time. And Hamber brought an important point about him not settling. But you look at the Palace squad back then. We had Flamini, Kabay, Loic Remy, Sacco. There's a lot of French-speaking players. Suarez.
Wilf speaks French.
Wilf, yeah. Exactly. Bakary Sacco. So it's interesting he didn't settle, considering there's so many French speaking players. And if you remember Pardew's reputation, he Newcastle loved a French player. A lot of French players would play for him. So it's a real shame, because I thought, again, at the time it was a really good signing. I like the progression to having a keeper, because that's what the Premier League really is now. Football in general is keepers that can play with their feet. And it's a shame. But like you said, Hambo, like, no one really knows what happened. He just kind of disappeared. He got taken out of the lineup, and then he went back to France, and he was gone and was never seen again. It was very the most bizarre situation of a player I've ever seen in Palace. And we've had a lot of bizarre situations.
I think something just occurred to me, which I think perhaps should have occurred to me earlier in why he didn't settle. If you think about the fact that if you're a ball playing goalkeeper and you're signed by a manager who's told you, right, we're going to play the ball out from the back. I want you to keep the passes short, play out to your defence, and we're going to work the ball up through the defence, into the midfield, into the attack, and play proper expansive football. If the players in front of you can't really do that, it must be quite disillusioning.
I was about to say, if you're passing to Joel Ward, then it's, you know, that's not necessarily the easiest thing to be doing. So, and bearing in mind the end of the last season, for Pardew to still be pushing the expansive football thing, I think at that point we just wanted some more direct football.
I think it's important to say, I mean, as you say, in terms of the people in front, one of them was Damien Delaney, you know, and it was the famous, you know, forward long ball left. And I know that we were saying don't do that, you know, that you needed that transition, but as you say, you can't make that transition if you don't sign the players to do it. And we hadn't done that. So, you know, no great surprise it didn't work out in retrospect, although it looked great at the time.
Well, that's probably the longest that anyone's talked about Steve Mandanda since he's gone. The same day, though, we got Andros Townsend from Newcastle for $13 million. So England international. A huge signing. I think everyone was fairly excited.
I think if you remember, he'd obviously playing for Newcastle. I think he only played half a season, and then they obviously got relegated. But against us, scored an absolute screamer. And, you know, he was fantastic in an England shirt for quite a long period of time as well. And I was quite surprised how things ended up going for him at Spurs, and how he kind of dropped out of the team and sort of lost a bit of form. And I thought he was really starting to re-emerge at Newcastle. And obviously, we took the decision, as I'm sure we'll get to sell Yannick Bolasie. And essentially what happened was Bolasie went for a huge sum of money. And for half that money, or less than half that money, we brought in Andros Townsend effectively as a replacement. And I think at the time, and I still probably think it's true, considering how things went, it was a tremendous bit of business. And it did take him a while to settle. And as we'll talk about with the managerial change, I think that's probably what helped him. But great player, really has embraced everything to do with being a Crystal Palace footballer, and is a key man at the club now.
What's frustrating about that is there was a decent period of time, a month or a couple of months, when we had Zaha, we had Townsend, and we had Bolasie. And it seemed like the Palace DNA, and that's a horrible term, but was these really flamboyant players, forward players on the left and right, and to have the three of them together, it was actually very disappointing. I mean, I know Patrick loves Bolasie probably equally or more than me, but the thought of them three together, obviously, it never really materialised, but that would have been amazing.
Yeah, Mike, I'll come back to that same exact time. I remember we had the three of them, and I thought, this is going to be absolutely brilliant. If one of them was out of form, we can use the other one. We're never going to be out of form. But it brought my heart to sell Yannick. But looking back on it, it was an absolutely great piece of business. I feel really bad that he went to Everton and got that injury. But Townsend has come here, and he's really, really done a great job. And every season he's got better and better. His work rate is phenomenal. And I just think it's been, you know, again, I love Yannick and I hated to see him go, but I have to admit that Townsend has come in and done a really great job for us.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And at the time of recording, he's still absolutely got it and his hair is far better than it was at that point. And then perhaps one of, I assume DR's absolutely favourite signing of that window, James Tompkins came in for the absolutely miserly sum of 10 million. How much has that man done in the last three and a bit years?
To jump straight in on this because I've got a be honest about this. So when we signed him, I don't know why I felt like this at the time, but I thought 10 million sounded like a large amount of money for Tompkins. And I think perhaps it came from the reaction of the West Ham fans to the news. It didn't take long for a lot of them to sort of say, what a stupid thing we've done here. But the initial reaction I think that I saw on social media was for them saying, how on earth have we managed to get 10 million for Tompkins? And I think that kind of eked its way into my mind, but it really didn't stay there very long because what a signing he has been. And I West Ham, I remembered him more again, because you don't see these players every week. You see them on Match of the Day and you see them in the occasional live game, but you know, we obviously have to be very focused on Palace as we would choose to be anyway. And I'd seen him play at right back and I'd seen him play in central midfield in his younger days as well. And I just kind of didn't really expect that we were going to get what we got. Yeah, he's had his injury problems, but you think about how good a signing Scott Dan was and how much of a difference he made. Tompkins has been another level to that. He's just been absolutely outstanding. And obviously later on paired with Mamasako, the two of them, are up there amongst the best centre-back partnerships in the league.
I mean, that just underlines what a sort of contrary, up-themselves bunch of fans West Ham are, because he played for them over 200 times. You know, I got the impression that he wasn't that keen to leave him either. So at the time, we were, you know, it seemed to me the most important signing because of the fact that our defence was ageing, was, you know, fairly porous the season before. You know, I didn't expect him to, but, you know, it wasn't like when Sacco came along and he was the second coming, but we needed to strengthen badly and 10 million didn't seem that much. But you're right, West Ham fans were saying, oh, we've done you, as they've said to many people in the past. And it just underlines the fact that you shouldn't listen to anything that West Ham fans ever say. So other than that, we had one Christian Benteke turn up for a hell of a lot of money just towards the end of the transfer window. And the even better Benteke as well, join on deadline day, Jonathan Benteke. And as far as I remember, we had to take Jonathan Benteke because Christian Benteke had it as a deal in his signing from Liverpool that his brother had to come as well. And I don't know which one of the Benteke brothers you want to talk about first, but
well, Jonathan, obviously. I do actually want to talk about Jonathan Benteke first, just for a bit of a giggle, really. But I don't think it was ever officially said that was the case, and I can vividly remember Pardew saying, "No, we've signed him because we believe that there's real talent."
Yeah,
there.
He did deny
know,
it.
Yeah, we've there's definitely a player in there. We're going to develop him, and we think there's big things ahead for Jonathan Benteke. Oldham, I think, were the big things ahead for Jonathan Benteke. I'm conscious that the other guys will want to jump in, but on Christian Benteke, can I just say that, you know, time might have changed people's opinions and caused people to sort of revise what they first thought. But first and foremost, to me, it was the next level of signing for the club. We'd done goodbye the year before, which was
you're still talking about Jonathan here, yeah?
yeah, absolutely. but yeah, Christian came along as well, which is all right. Now, in all seriousness, we were linked with him, and I just thought, no, come on. You know, it was a Villa player. He was superb. I don't think he got the opportunities he should have got at Liverpool. They didn't seem to play in a way that suited him, which we all know what his strengths are. But again, seeing the highlights rather than seeing him play every single game, you know, the overhead kick that he scored for Liverpool early on really sticks in my memory. And I just thought, how on earth are we in the market for a player of that talent? And I think to me, it was a great signing. And I think that year it was proven to be a great signing. Obviously, what has happened since has coloured that somewhat. But this season in particular, 15 league goals, 17 overall, he was everything that we thought we were signing. When we played to his strengths, when we got the ball in the box, and obviously we had Townsend and Zaha playing wide, creating all sorts of opportunities for them, and he just didn't miss. He was absolutely superb for us. Led the line properly, played as a proper striker, and I just thought we've solved it. We've solved the problem. We've got him for, you know, I think it was a 4-year contract we've got him on, and we've paid a big sum of money, and it's worth every penny. We bought a proper proven Premier League striker.
You've covered about 90% of what I was going to say there, Chris, so I won't repeat it. But the core point about that was, it was, as you said, a next level signing. For Palace to be signing someone from a Champions League type club was really strange and great. And I mean, the other thing that I think is quite important is the previous season had ended on such a low. I mean, such a high as well, obviously, with the fact that we got to the FA Cup final. But the drift and the awfulness of that league campaign shouldn't be underestimated. And, you know, I mean, there was a lot of depression and fear and worry at the start of that season. That signing changed a lot. You know, the feeling around the club was so much more optimistic when he came. I wasn't a huge fan of his before he came to us, not least because I seem to remember him going down rather easily for a penalty against us. And I never like players who do that against us. And yet, you know, as a signing, you know, it was really exciting, and it did work. For that season alone, that was worth it. Any time that you spend that much money and it ultimately results in the goals that keep you up, that's worth doing on its own terms.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point, and it's still the biggest transfer fee that we've put out, not by much, but it is. The one other signing actually came as he was a free agent, and it just after the end of the transfer window, Flamini came in, and I assume that the rest of you, like me, knew he was probably over the hill, but had this sort of beautiful memories of his sort of silky football and assumed he could do the same for us as he did for Arsenal. Obviously never really transpired, but he was a squad player and there when we had some injuries. Sorry, who's someone going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say I was more excited about these. His, I can't remember what it was. It biochemical company that he'd started? I was more fascinated about that when he signed, to be honest with you. but I haven't Googled that recently, so I can't remember exactly what it was about.
Fair enough. Well, while I'm chatting, feel free to look up Flamini Enterprises. So I'm glad you're on, Patrick, because the pre-season games were the American tour. So I presume you kept an eye on that. I know we won at Cincinnati.
Yeah, I went, because of my proximity, I'm in New York, I went to the Philadelphia match, which was, the first game of the tour. So I did get to see a play. That was a game we mentioned before in the previous about Freddy Ladapo. We got to see him play a little bit. So Pardew, basically, because at that point we hadn't signed Benteke, we were kind of looking for a striker. So Ladapo played a bit. It wasn't a very exciting game, if my memory serves me. I'm pretty sure it was a 0-0 draw. But we ended up also going to play against Cincinnati. They were at that time were a USL League One team. Now they're in the MLS. They progressed through the ranks, not through promotion relegation, but just through spending a lot of money to get a franchise fee. And we also went up to Vancouver, played the Whitecaps. And at that point, a certain Jordan Much scored. Jordan Much.
Come on, mate.
I couldn't help making him up. I couldn't help it because I'm pretty sure he scored in that game, the exhibition game. So, but I had to bring up because I know how much Chris likes him. So that's my little thing. But it was a pretty successful tour again. It was the whole point being, obviously, with us having American investors, it was a nice way to kind of spread the brand. And as an American fan, and a lot of American fans over here, we were very happy to have them be on the East Coast for the most part to get to see them play those matches. So that was nice.
Can I just, I know Chris is going to jump in now, but it was GF Biochemicals that Flamini started with his friend Pascal Granata. And they're the first company in the world that mass produce levulinic acid, which is obviously, as you all know, is a an additive in degradable herbicides.
Oh, great. So he had enough money from football, but he'd still decided that he'd start a company that would sort of increase global warming and that kind of thing.
Well, I think it was it's supposed to help.
Fair play.
Potentially a £1 billion company producing biodegradable herbicides. So I think you owe him an apology.
Don't sue us. We're sorry.
He's very rich from that company. I believe Mesut Ozil is a big investor in that company also. So he made a lot of his friends very, very rich. So I'm jealous.
A lot of things have made Ozil rich.
Winning the World Cup.
Yeah, let's carry on.
I mean, the other thing that I wanted to bring in was just the number of players that exited that summer. We're coming to that. Super. Well,
we're coming to that. So, I had a nice the Valencia game. We won 3-1, and I remember thinking this was really lucky. We didn't deserve to win this 3-1, and one of the goal scorers was Jedinak. So at that point, he was still a player. By the end of the transfer window, he'd gone, which was huge. So he went to Villa for $4 million. After that game as well. We lost Yannick Bolasie, as mentioned earlier, to Everton for $25 million, which was a huge amount of money, but I was absolutely devastated. And I assume not everyone had the same feeling, but for a couple of seasons, I felt that he'd have done as much as Zaha had. And I was absolutely gutted. And obviously, after the injury at Everton, he's not managed to recover quite the same form. But we're talking about a player that had done wonders for us. He was absolutely the top of his game. So 25 million, if you compare that to the 27 million for Benteke, obviously at the time people were saying, you know, we've got Benteke basically for free, swapping him for Bolasie. Well, I mean, that to me still, it's a great shame that he went. We did lose quite a few players. We lost Adebayor, sadly released. Shimak was released.
Gutted.
Ended up at Cardiff. And anyone that's got a bad word to say about him is wrong. Hangeland had retired at that point. Mariappa went to Watford, which was a shame.
Sorry, Mike, you skipped Chris Kettins there, mate. Remember Chris Kettins?
I was going to get to him last, don't worry.
Oh, okay.
Paddy McCarthy. Gone as a free agent. Dwight Gale to Newcastle, which, you know, as I mentioned in the Valencia game, when it seemed like we were short on strikers, you know, as Patrick had said, we had Freddie Ladapo in the friendlies. Well, you know, to lose Dwight Gale was, I know he hadn't seemed like he'd done that great in the Premier League, but Alex McCarthy, as we'd mentioned in the last episode, went to Southampton. But the big one, the one that, as Chris has mentioned, really, really got to him. He was a player. He's still got the poster on his wall. Chris Kettins to Oldham Athletic.
Yeah, do you remember Chris Kettins? Old Chris Kettins, didn't he? He was the old, stood in the old goal there.
Not until you brought him up the other day and started tweeting about him.
He was the one who wore the gloves. You know, he wore the gloves. Remember? Remember that?
Scottish international. What's he doing now? Well, I mean, presumably you're following him day by day.
He's still goalkeeping away with gloves, uses gloves, playing in goal. Patrick, did you want to talk about Bolasie at all?
Yeah. I actually want to talk about Jedinak. Okay. Because we talked about Bolasie. Jedinak leaving is not being spoken about enough. Mile Jedinak was, for me, probably our best captain in the Premier League era, as far as I'm concerned. He was absolutely phenomenal. His leadership, his goals, his penalties, free kicks, he was an absolute huge, huge, huge player. I mean, he brought us up, you know, in the championship side, captain that side. I think I don't know what the issue was between him and the managers. Obviously, it had to have been one, because to do the person like that from the locker room, because you're talking about a time when, you know, we talked about in a previous one about the coffee club thing Chris has mentioned, but they have leaders like, but like Jedinak and Delaney in that room was important, and we lost them. And I think honestly, I think that had a lot to do with how things kind of fell apart for us as a club during this time. I think not having leaders that were, you know, could step up. And Jenik as a player was just, I just thought it was great. And I think that that loss to me was huge. I'm a huge Milan Jenik fan. Very huge.
For me, you're absolutely right in terms of the personalities. But this, and from what, I've heard, and again, this is just things that you hear in and around the club, that this was part of a period where Pardew had looked at the previous season and decided that the problem was that there were too many influential personalities in the squad, and that he really wanted to kind of he wanted to be the main man, and that's always how he's managed. That, you know, to a degree, if you're going to put a manager in place, you've got to let them manage how they want to. But that's what he did. You know, obviously, few personalities left the club. I mean, Paddy McCarthy was one as well, and obviously later on, I think at the start of the next season, Delaney was manoeuvred out as well. But Jedinak was obviously the big personality at the club. He was very much the leader, and he wasn't just about on the field. He demanded incredibly high standards of everyone around him, and obviously he would be the one that would speak up to the manager if things weren't right. And I think we talked about it in the last show, and we know from what's going to happen as we talk through this show, things weren't right at the football club. So you can bet your life that Mile Jednak was telling Alan Pardew that on a regular basis, and you know, something had to give. And unfortunately, I kind of think that the money we got and the age that he was, and you look how he done a brilliant job playing at Villa in a division below, probably it was the right time to move him on. But I think the reasons were wrong. And if we could have kept him around as a captain, not necessarily playing every week, I think a more pragmatic manager would have done that, and we would have benefited from that.
I understand what you said, and you're absolutely right with that. But I want to add one thing. The way we were trying to play was interesting, the more expansive style. But by losing Mile Jednak, it took us that whole transfer window in January till we got Luka to come in to plug that hole. We never had a holding midfielder in that mold until Luka came in, and that was big for me. So I understand the issues with the personalities, but from a field standpoint, I think Pod, you missed a trick there.
Well, proof that you do not argue with the twat in the cravat. it's a big shame. He is at the time of recording a free agent, but you're right. I mean, the club captains we've had since Scott Dunn, replaced by Punchin, and then Luka, who is a great captain but doesn't quite have the dominance on the pitch to make the kind of decisions that Jedinak did. You know, he doesn't run in when he doesn't save Zaha from himself in the same way, that kind of thing. So yeah, he's a free agent, that's all I'm saying. One other quick in, Loic Remy came in on loan. That's probably enough about that.
Yep.
Start of the season, we lost 1-0 to West Brom. We lost 1-0 to Pulis' West Brom, Solomon Rondon goal. And just before we came on air, Hambo actually had the first 11 for that team. So let's just rattle through it quickly.
Yeah, certainly interesting, and especially when you look at some of the decisions as well. So we started the game with Wayne Hennessy in goal, Joel Ward at right back, Scott Dan, Damien Delaney, centre backs, Pep Soare, left back, who was replaced by Martin Kelly in the 90th minute. Great sub that when you're losing the game, isn't it? What's the point in that? Anyway, Mile Jednak did start that game. Jason Punchin alongside him was replaced by Johan Kabay after 76 minutes. Not sure why Kabay was on the bench for that. Wilfried Zaha played, Chung Yong Lee played, with Bolasie coming on for him in the 65th minute, Andros Townsend and Connor Wickham. And the subs that weren't used that day, Julian Speroni. sorry, I've just noticed there's an Anderson in there. Who's Anderson?
Keshi Anderson?
Oh, Keshi Anderson, there you go. Thank you for saving me there. So it was Joe Ledley, Keshi Anderson, and Freddie Ladapo, really showing our striking problems.
Yeah, absolutely. That start was perpetuated by the first of, I think, is still going, a string of 1-0 defeats to Spurs. I don't think it's been broken in the league. I might be wrong. But yeah, depressing start to the season. So we were 19th by the end of the second game. But then in two streaky style from Pardew, five games without a defeat. And it started with a 1-0 draw at home to Bournemouth, which, and I know, I can't remember if it was this episode or last episode, Hambo was talking about how magical it is to get a really late winner or a really late draw. This was one of the ones I really remember people going mental for. Scott Dan header, deep into injury time to rescue a point. And it suddenly felt like we were away. That was a big point. Then a 2-1 away to middle, 2-1 away win to Middlesbrough. And that, I think that was the only side that we actually beat home and away that season. And then excellent 4-1 win at home to Stoke, which I'm sure people have big old memories of. We were 4-0 up, and they were lucky to get one at all. It was a bit annoying that they managed to ruin the clean sheet. And then that game at the Stadium of the Light where we were 2-0 down, and there was only about 25 minutes to go. We ended up winning 3-2 with a Benteke injury time winner. So let's discuss that period.
Yeah, I've got to say, again, you talked about the Scott Dan last minute goal. The Benteke last minute winner against Sunderland was absolutely beautiful. We had the same situation where, they had Jermaine Defoe, so obviously he was going to score against us. But again, we really battled pretty well in that game. And as you say, it was in a good streak. The win against Stoke was comprehensive. Obviously, our tails were up. Probably the big thing is that starting with the Bournemouth draw, that was the first game for Benteke. Then he scored in the game against Borough and scored in the game, obviously the winner against Sunderland as well. So suddenly we had a proper striker leading the line. We didn't have Keshi Anderson and Freddie Ledepo on the bench. We were started like a proper team. So you kind of almost put to the back of your mind, didn't you, the poor start and how bad we'd been in the end to the previous season, and we're starting to look optimistic and think about all the players we'd signed and how, hopefully we can start pushing up the league. And it wasn't to be.
I want to just add something about Benteke's goals that season. You mentioned about the 15 goals and some of the late winners. My memory serves, I remember talking about this on one of our shows way back that during the season. I think there's only one match that he scored in and we didn't get a point out of. That was the 5-4 Swansea match. Every time he scored a goal, we either get a point or won the game. That's how important it was to us that season. So people make the comments about Benteke and his lack of form. The way he played that season, playing to his strengths, look at those goals. Tons and tons of headed goals, tons of goals in the box. That's what he does. And we've gone away from that. But when he would score goals in that season, we would get pick-up points.
Yeah, good point. And then we ended that particular run with a 1-1 draw against Everton, left us eighth in the table. Now, the next point is something I totally forgot, so whoever kindly put this into the show programme, thank you. That was the point of the Soiree car crash. I didn't realise it was that long ago, showing my age. So whoever put that in, thank you. I think it was you, Chris.
It was me. I think that was a turning point, actually, because we're about to look at how the subsequent games go. And you look at what options we had at left back once Soiree was out of the picture. The answer was, basically you'd got Zeki Friars, remember him? Enough said. You'd got Joel Ward if you swapped him round, which we then didn't have any cover at right back. You had Martin Kelly, who could play there, which was actually, I think, generally what happened. You could ask Joe Ledley to do the role, but then that left us without cover in defensive midfield. So really not a good situation, as well as obviously a personal tragedy, for a player who we haven't really seen the best of since. It's a real shame because he was looking really good at that point.
Yeah, that's a great bit of knowledge, and it makes me feel old to think that was that long ago. And great that he's back and playing now, and at the time of recording, hope he finds a decent club. So yeah, six losses on the bounce following that, the sixth being, we'll get to that in a minute, one of the worst games of all time. But 1-0 home loss to West Ham. Remember that hurting. 3-1 away loss to Leicester City. Remember them absolutely dicking all over us. 4-2 loss at home to Liverpool. And I vaguely remember that it was 2-2. I think we went 1-0 down, 2-0 down, but came back both times. And then they ended up finishing off with their quality. 3-2 away loss to Burnley. That hurt a lot. 2-1 home loss to Man City. No big surprise there. And then one of the worst games, as I say, of all time. Swansea City 5, Crystal Palace 4. The one where we were 4-3 up in injury time and we lost the game. And much like the FA Cup final, I've still not got over that.
I think what shouldn't be missed is the psychological damage of that game. And let's face it, it was that game that saw the end of Alan Pardew. I think, you know, there was a couple of things that happened since, which we'll get, afterwards, which we'll get into. But I didn't ever really have any hope in that game. Even when we went 4-3 up, I kind of felt that we'd cheated it a little bit and that we were going to get away with it. And this was really in a period, and I know for absolute definite, Patrick will know what I'm talking about, where you were almost, not quite, but you were almost thinking, well, I actually don't want us to get a result here because something has to change. And if we get a result, it's just another excuse to prolong the agony. You know, the guy's lost the dressing room. We're not playing football the right way. He thinks this is the way to operate, and it's absolutely killing us. So, but it didn't stop it being devastating. And I remember choosing not to travel to this game. But I remember speaking to Terence about it, and his reaction was just, you know, it was so visceral. It's one of the worst things I've ever experienced watching a Palace game. It just kept hurting, and you know, and as you say, it kind of still does. It's not quite as bad as the FA Cup final, but
it's not even the worst pain of the season either. We haven't got to the Sunderland game yet, but yeah, go for it, Chris.
So, I mean, I was at that game, and I mean, it's memorable for lots of reasons. But I'm going to tell a little anecdote, if I may. So we were with a mate called Jason who passed out when we went 4-3 up. And it was genuinely, I mean, yeah, so the guy, he's younger than me, he's like in his 30s, and he not only passed out, it was a suspected heart attack. Don't worry, the story has a happy ending-ish.
Okay.
You know, suspected heart attack, like paramedics on him, all sorts. We didn't even know this, although he was with us, he was sat somewhere else or stood somewhere else. So he passed out watching us go 4-3 up and came to as it was 5-4. So I mean, I already love this story, but the worst thing about that is that then, because he, you know, basically he'd had this suspected heart attack, they then had to take him to hospital. So we had to stay in Swansea, and obviously we were all booked on trains and stuff, so we had to leave him. And he had to stay overnight. I mean, he's all right now, and I mean, occasionally I see him and, you know, away games and things, and I ask him, you know, how are you and so on. And I mean, literally, as far as we can tell, there's nothing wrong with his heart. It was just a one-off. You know, they did some tests, nothing else. So talking of injuries, that then brings me to the other one, which is that it was at this game that Connor Wickham suffered that absolutely wrenching injury, which was horrible. I mean, I know I winced and sucked my teeth at the moment that, you know, that his boot got stuck in the ground and he twisted his knee, because you could see that it was possibly a career-ending injury and certainly a season-ending injury. Absolutely horrible moment. We'll talk about the goals and stuff, I guess, but I mean, if we want to prolong the torture, but my God, what an incredible game. The other thing is the fans turned that day. I mean, there'd been a brewing discontent for about 6 months, as we all know, especially with the awful form the previous year. But that day they were singing, you know, that they wanted him out. They were singing, you don't know what you're doing. I mean, I remember there were even people on our side who cheered when they went ahead. It was a really weird feeling, and you know, I remember getting involved in a few ding-dongs with people because I was still bizarrely loyal to the regime at that stage, you know, pure affection of having got us to a cup final, even though it led to a heartbreak. So yeah, a really memorable and weird day.
Yeah, but this was coming, and I think you need to go back and look at the two previous matches. We lost a 3-2 game to Burnley. We gave up a goal to Volks in the first minute and gave up a goal to Barnes in the 94th minute. So it was coming. That was two matches before. The match before the Swansea game was this Man City game. You remember Yaya Touré scoring a late winner in that game. So he had shown no ability to manage at this point. It was just gung-ho, put the players out there, do what they may. So when Swansea came around, Campbell's correct. It didn't bother me. I was hoping for something to happen because I needed this man to go. He had to go. He was facing, at that time, an American manager named Bob Bradley. Bob Bradley had just gotten the job at Swansea. He's not a very good manager. He was an national team manager. There was a lot of hype over here because, you know, they wanted American to do well, blah, 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 blah. And the first match he goes up against, he beats Alan Pardew 5-4. So everybody here was going crazy. As I'm sure you guys know, you know he was fired this season, right? Bob Bradley.
Yeah. No, he was awful for them. Absolutely awful. But yeah, still won against us.
Right. So this was always going to happen. Alan Pardew had shown this season he had lost the ability to manage his team.
You're right.
And this result to me was coming. I'm sorry that Mike feels badly about it. I'm not bothered by this result at the time at all. It didn't bother me. It really didn't bother me that much because I just saw this coming for the entire season. Mm-hmm. To me, this was just icing on the cake, Mikey. Mike, sorry.
You're right. And the interesting thing in this period of defeats, we scored 10. But I always had, especially that Burnley game, I always had the feeling that however many we scored, yes, we would concede one more.
Exactly. Beautifully put.
So, yeah, absolutely right. It was not surprise. I was absolutely heartbroken. And then it was only prolonged by a sudden freakish 3-0 win at home to Southampton. and then a 3-0 draw away at Hull with a late Fraser Campbell equaliser, which I think was probably his last goal for the club. I might be wrong there, but those games, yeah, absolutely. Those games saved Pardew for a few days.
Well, they did in a lot of ways, but I know we talked about this before we started recording, but I just want to say it in the recorded environment. The smugness from Pardew after the 3-0 win against Southampton completely belies how terrible we'd been for nearly a full calendar year, right? For a full calendar year, we'd won, four games at this point, I think?
We won six games altogether in 2016.
So, yeah, so this, there you go. So this was the sixth game. So we beat Southampton 3-0, which was the sixth game in the entire of 2016 that we won. Yeah, afterwards, he comes out strutting like he's the mastermind in the biggest victory that anyone's ever seen, thanking everybody like he's won an award. You know, I just want to like to thank the chairman. And, you know, I remember him saying, he was like, we have to educate the American owners about how things work. And going back to him being a streaky manager and thinking it's normal. And he was just absolutely convinced that this was the turning point. We beat a pretty poor Southampton team at the time. They were struggling a little bit at home. And that was it. You know, that was it. We're going to win the league or whatever. But it prolongs the agony to a point. But I still maintain that the club were clearly looking elsewhere. And they definitely would have been after the 5-4. I think that this was just, it didn't really matter what he did after that.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. You in? Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee, and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
I mean, you're right, because he was sacked after two very, very difficult games, Man United and Chelsea. So he was sacked on December the 22nd. And December the 23rd, we appointed Sam Allardyce, fresh from his pint of wine sipping, being caught in the act. England's one game as a manager, sacked for trying to sell random bits of information. We got him at the very bottom of his career, I think. And that was in a bid to save the season.
I've got to say, I don't know if Mikey will dig out some clips of us talking about it when he was appointed, but certainly myself and Terence went on record being very, very dead against the appointment, and I certainly won't be revisionist in saying this. I do remember at the time saying that I felt that, you know, the sting was kind of, it showed the kind of character that he is, and I still believe he is that kind of a character. I think, again, if you analyse it, and I know a fair few people, even, I think Steve Parish went on record as saying that if you actually look at it, he didn't really do much wrong. He actually said that you can't, you know, he was happy to give a talk or whatever, but you know, he wasn't going to do anything against the rules, and technically he didn't break any rules, but it just wasn't right, was it? But more importantly, I think at the time I found it distasteful, but I did say he will undoubtedly keep us up. That's the one thing, and he certainly went on to do that. And I do look back on it, his period at the club, with a bit more affection than I thought I ever would.
Yeah, I was pretty happy because I knew he'd keep us up, or I was fairly confident. I got less confident, in fairness, when stuff started coming up after a poor run that he'd sort of lost his mojo. So we got a point away at Watford straight away. It's a shame because we were winning. Troy Deeney, with one of those games where he hurt us, got the equaliser. But then after that, 6 defeats in 7. And there was lots of talk in the media about Allardyce being just absolutely shot after the England thing, because that's all he ever wanted to do. Chris, what are we gonna add to that?
So I was just jumping in to talk about the change that happened, and you know, the importance of Allardyce coming in the first place. Because I remember that one of the concerns that was articulated at the time was, you know, very much that he was a manager who would buy success, and you know, wasn't about investing in the future of the club. So he'd do what he needed to do to get himself the plaudits, but not invest in, you know, the future. You know, so I mean, we were talking about the academy to a certain extent. That he wouldn't be interested in all of that stuff. But, I mean, we'll come to the transfer window in a second, and actually those purchases were incredibly wise purchases in retrospect, and not just for one season. You know, those players have gone on to be with us for a long time. That's what I wanted to steer us toward.
No, you hit the nail on the head, Chris. That was the complaint that I made at the time, I think, which was that even if you look at the club, you know, you look at Bolton, where he spent a long period of time. When he left, he didn't leave any kind of a legacy. He left a team that fell apart. He was very big on signing big reputation players at the end of their careers. And that was the fear that I had for him coming into Palace. I always felt that it could only be a short-term appointment and we should be looking further afield. And it did pan out that way. But having said that, part of me thinks I would have loved him to stay on. But yeah, he certainly wasn't going to be a manager to come in and build a club. And I think it did play out that way.
Yeah, and to add to that, listen, the signings he made in that window were phenomenal. Sacco, Schlupp, Milivojevic and Van Aanholt. But they came at a huge price. And we could never have sustained keeping Allardyce for 2-3 seasons because he would have kept on spending that kind of money. He just would have. And I think that's the problem that I would have had with him. Like you, Chris, I was not a Sam Allardyce fan in the least. Like Mike, I thought he'd keep us up, which is the only thing I was happy with. He was there. But I think a season or two or three of Allardyce would have put us in not only huge financial issues, but I think eventually he would have got us relegated.
I think by that point in his career, he'd learned that he was only ever going to stay with someone to keep them up because that's what he's good at. And it was all short-termism, but that's exactly what we needed. What I will get onto is a tweet, and we'll discuss the rest later, I promise, from Cav saying he wants to discuss how Big Sam had Frigg all to do with it. Couldn't believe his luck and the actual quality of the players. Just needed a bit of galvanising, and he was fairly lucky with the end of the season results. But what I would say is, and he's come out on record and made this clear many times, the players that came in the January window had a whole lot to do with him, and they've ended up being a huge part of our squad. So we'll get into them. Jeff Schlupp came in from Leicester for 9 million. Had been a obviously a Premier League winner, although, you know, was in and out of the team for them and seemed a little bit surplus to requirements. Patrick Van Aanholt from Sunderland, who had looked good against us for 10 million. I think we're all fairly happy with that. Fairly unknown quantity from Olympiakos, Luka Milivojevic. Nobody knew much about him until they looked at his record and realised quite how much he'd done. And then the big one, right on the last day of the end of the transfer window, right in the last few minutes, the player that we'd all wanted, Mamadou Sakho. So he pulled in some really big players there. And I've got to say, without those players, I really don't see we would have stayed up.
I think that's the point in answering the message from Kev. When you read it out, I do kind of agree that there's an element to the fact he's joined a squad that was better than it was showing, and by some quite considerable distance, to be fair. But I think you have to be honest and say, even with the January signings, the players that were already at the club needed a lot of love and attention to get them back to the level that they needed to be. And it took him time to do that. You know, we've been through the fact that we lost 6 out of 7 games after the Watford draw. And, you know, it didn't look great for quite a long period of time. And even in comments in the press, Allardyce was saying okay, it seems to be a harder job than I thought it was going to be. But I think he also went on record as saying that it would probably be March before you really see the impact of the coaching and the organisation. And that very much came to pass as well. So I think it's unfair to say he had nothing to do with it. I think he was a huge factor in it. And even when you look at the quality of the squad that was there, he still had to get them motivated and playing. And probably none more so than the reported intervention by Sammy Lee with Andros Townsend that really got Andros firing on all cylinders as well. So I can't agree with Kev, but I understand the point.
This is a spot on. The other thing he said plenty of times was he couldn't believe the level of fitness in the players. You know, they were clear. I know a lot of managers come in from other managers and say, well, I needed to get them fit. But it was clearly obvious after the Swansea game, after the Burnley game, we kept losing late goals. Late goals were a real problem at that point. And it's because the players clearly didn't have the fitness levels that you need in the Premier League, and he did the basics. I'm sure you're right, Kevin. Other managers would have done a similar thing, but he just pulled back and made sure that the basics were there in a way that Pardew hadn't done.
The thing I'm loving about doing these shows is that it reminds you of, you know, the kind of little nuances of detail. So one of them about this particular season is that the transfer window fell on the same day as the Bournemouth away game. And at the time of that game, Christian Benteke had been on a bit of a dry run in terms of goal scoring. His previous goal had been on the 10th of December when he scored a penalty against Hull. You're looking at 31st of January, so nearly 2 months without a goal. Perhaps a taste of things to come.
Yeah, for sure. And again, he benefited from the change of approach from Allardyce, I think, that got him scoring again. But I want to go back to the point Mike was making about the fitness, because it just popped back into my mind. Do you remember Yohan Cabaye could barely play more than 45 minutes,
yeah,
and James McArthur couldn't do more than an hour. You know, yeah, Cabaye was 30 at the time, maybe 31 at a push. McArthur was 27 at the time, probably. And there's no way those two should be struggling. And you think about the engine that McArthur's got even now at the time of recording. he's always box to box. He was that player that gets back to block a shot on the line, and 10 seconds later, he seems to be right up the other end of the pitch. And I think when Allardyce walked through the door, he did look at both those players and recognise that they could only contribute in small periods of the game, and he managed them accordingly. And again, then he had to bring those levels up. So it's a really good point that you bring up. It wasn't just about the late goals. It was the restrictions that it put on our squad, because the players just weren't in the right shape to actually play professional football at times.
Yeah, and when you think back to you know, people in the press were saying, well, it's got to be because of Allardyce being shot from England. I really don't think that was the case. And it shows because we went on an excellent run from them from then on. So 6 wins in 8, starting with an absolutely crucial game, a 1-0 win against Middlesbrough at home. Remember it vividly. PVA long range goal late on in the game. You know, it had been pretty much a stalemate until that point. But PVA showed his quality fairly early on after signing with an absolutely excellent finish. And it was new to it was certainly new to me for a long time to see a player at the back that loved to get forward. And you know, it makes sense. You know, when you watch games in the Championship, players are naturally more limited. So you've got defenders and they are defenders. I know it's also because of the fact that the game's changing and it's more fashionable now. But to see PVA shoot forward, and he's carried on doing it since then, that was an amazing goal. And it started off 4 wins in a row. And at that point, we were still in the relegation zone after the Middlesbrough game, but it definitely gave hope.
Another thing, Mike, I noticed that right before that game was the game that Allardyce gave Jason Punch in the captaincy. And I think his leadership, though he didn't contribute with goals that season, his leadership really helped us with Allardyce to hoop us up that year.
That's a great shout. I mean, it was Scott Dan was the captain, wasn't he? And he literally took it off him and handed it
to Punch.
Yeah. And
we remember people complained about that at the time.
Yeah, well, Dan was, I think a lot of people said it as well. And I know we definitely talked about it on our show that whilst he was an influential player, he didn't seem to shout. Yeah, exactly. He wasn't vocal. Yeah. And he just needed someone to bring it all together. And that's when all the huddles started with punching and all that stuff. Yeah, great memory.
Although, that said, before we start that brilliant six in eight run, we've also got the unfortunate issue of the home game against Sunderland, which
come on mate, we'd skip that. Come on,
you can't skip that. You can't skip it. I mean,
fair enough.
Apart from anything else, so many people walked out of that game, and that needs to be. I mean, it was obviously a very very depressing performance, and I can understand why you would want to skip it. But, you know, it needs to be talked about. And, you know, I mean, enough said, frankly, is just to mention it. And the fact that it was such a numbing performance to watch. You know, I mean, there was a huge amount of anger around the club, you know, and actually the fans were divided among themselves as well about that, because there was obviously the walkout and the sheer number. I've never seen so many people leave a game. At half time as well, because it was already 4-0 at half time, wasn't it? And actually, we weathered the storm later on. So, yeah, I stayed for what it's worth. I wanted to flag that up just because, yeah, you have to remember the lows, because in a way, that match was a turning point, because it provoked some of those changes, I think.
That was a dark day. I mean, I don't think I came back from the bar until 75 minutes in. That was a tough day. At that point, I was starting to be resigned to the fact that Allardyce wasn't going to turn it around. I can't think of a worse 45 minutes of football I've ever seen for Palace. You know, there was plenty of people when I got back to Social Club later that had said that they'd left at half time, and I could not blame them. And these are people that don't leave early in games, but. It's just, you know, it's sobering. 4-0 against a team that finished rock bottom in the league. And they were a poor team that season. Defoe aside, they were a terrible side. So, you know, I can imagine Allardyce coming off that bit, bricking himself that he actually was going to ruin his record of not keeping every team up that he's managed. But yeah, you're right to bring that up, and apologies for missing it out. Going back to the winning run, we then had a 2-0 away win at West Brom, got some revenge over Pulis, goals from Zahar and Townsend, and that was the first time we climbed out the bottom three. Then a 1-0 win against Watford, and the excellent 2-1 away win at Chelsea, where we turned around being 1-0 down, and that, in my mind anyway, was Hennessy's best game in a Palace shirt.
Yeah, I was at that one, and obviously all the goals came really quickly, didn't they? Because Fabregas scored very early on, but Zaha scored an absolutely brilliant goal, and then it was only a couple of minutes later that Benteke scored, and we just held them after that. And it was weird. I didn't expect us not to be in trouble for the rest of that game, but I really don't, whether my memory is correct or not, I don't recall us having any real difficulty holding them off in any major way until quite late on, where the pressure was starting to build a little. But that was an amazing win, and it wasn't the last amazing win either.
The Benteke goal in particular, the technique on that with the way that he lifted it over the keeper was just amazing. I wanted to just refer back to a couple of the incidents from those games in that run. So one of them was the West Brom away win where Townsend scored that very, very memorable goal where he ran the length of the pitch and then collapsed and laid on his back afterwards.
Brilliant.
Because it was really, really late in the game as well. A slight comedy thing from the win against Watford, which was that it was Deeney who scored the own goal. What a shame that led us to win that game 1-0. And also, I was just looking through some of the facts and figures, and I was amused to note that one of the referees in one of these games was a known dog lover.
I think we might have to edit that out, Mikey, if you're listening. If you can just... could just draw just definitely clip that bit out, otherwise there could be problems.
Keep it in.
Unbelievable.
You just reminded me about the Watford game. We didn't have a shot on target in that game, did we? It was Deeney's own goal was the only chance we had as well. But absolutely. Some great memories. And then not too long after, I know we lost to Southampton, but then probably the game of the season, the 3-0 win over Arsenal, and then the 2-1 win at Liverpool.
I mean, the goals against Arsenal, I mean, particularly Kabay's, I just went the way he sort of slid that ball, the ball in the net. It was sort of a side foot, long range effort, and that was vintage Kabay. I loved every second of that. And beating Arsenal as well, just convincingly outplaying them, that was just glorious.
So, great point, Chris. We never beat Arsenal. I mean, I can't remember the last time we beat Arsenal. And that was a Monday night game under the lights. I mean, that was what Sellers was all about. It was rocking it.
They were having a shit run at that point, though, weren't they? If I remember rightly, it wasn't as much of a surprise as...
Yeah, but they were unbeaten at Sellers Park in 37 years.
Oh yeah, absolutely, so, absolutely. But it was the time to play him, if I remember
you
rightly.
You are absolutely right. They weren't playing well, but a great point about Kabay's goal. It was a brilliant goal, but the whole performance was great. You know, Lucas' penalty kick. I mean, it was a fantastic night. It really was. It was a great game. It was, I guess, a credit. You know, to beat Arsenal, Chelsea, Liverpool. And I remember at the end, we were all talking about that run being an absolutely horrific run. We're going to have problems. And him to get 9 points from those three matches is actually fantastic. It really was.
And Liverpool game, let's not forget the Benteke goal that was celebrated with Sako to beat them 2-1. And for the Liverpool fans to point out that he was still a Liverpool player celebrating with Benteke. Right. One of the greatest things I've ever seen. Still a meme now. Well worth being a meme. So at that point, we were up to 12th. And actually, we didn't do well towards the end of the season. And it got a little bit shaky again. But the 4-0 win against Hull at home, which utterly any little stress we had left, totally gone. I think we scored after an error after about a couple of minutes, didn't we?
Yeah, we relegated them that day as well. And I can remember because Marco Silva was getting so much attention, wasn't he, at the time? Because they were sort of dead and buried, and he'd done a similar kind of recovery job on them. They had a period where they were just winning everything. I think particularly at home.
They went above us in the league as well.
But he then, when the pressure counted, they just absolutely fell apart that day. And it just, as you say, took all the pressure off and was a lovely way to see out our the home part of our season.
I remember going off to, because I got a season ticket at the Oval as well, so after the game finished, a load of Palace fans descended on there. It was a four-day game, so we could bring our own cans in. We were all already absolutely slaughtered, and we didn't care one bit about the cricket. It was great. So, we ended with a Man United defeat. Nobody was too bothered. So we finished up 14th, which was an improvement on the 15th of the season before, which was odd because we spent the majority of the time this season in the bottom three, whereas we hadn't done that the season before. So Allardyce had done another saving job. We haven't mentioned the cup runs because we didn't bother that season. There was a win over Blackpool and Bolton in a replay, but that was it. It was all about survival that season. And to me, it's a tough one to call, but I think possibly, boys, the biggest saving job that was done in any season in the Premier League for me.
I think it's up there, isn't it? I'm just trying to think.
Do you know what? Yeah, I'm going to have to give Hodgson that when the bottom season with when you lose your first seven matches and you've got to come in and try and correct that. I think this is probably second, honestly.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing that crossed my mind. It's just it was kind of when you do a saving job, you usually are coming in halfway through a season, sure, aren't you, to try and turn something around. Whereas that was a very, very early change. But yeah, it's a slightly different comparison. But yeah, I mean, whatever way you look at it, it was incredibly impressive.
In the 25th game, we were 19th that season. I mean, he did wonders to end up 14th.
No, you're right.
So we're going to go over some listener comments, memories of the game. Obviously, some we've already covered. We posted up a beautiful picture of the whole game. One meathead, Minecraft Maguire, suffering while he was in a whole shirt as Benteke scored. That was a beautiful thing to look up earlier. So Palace Ash said Zaha's goal against Hull. That was the first one I think he's talking about there. Great. Benteke scoring against Chelsea. Whilst we were celebrating Wilf's equaliser. Yeah, as Hambo said, those goals came very fast. Yeah. PVA starting relegating teams, fair enough. John James, losing 4-0 to Sunderland showed how strong the supporters were after me saying that I stayed in the bar until 75 minutes. And what a response the squad and staff had. Absolutely true. Cav, we've already covered. Stephen Kingdom, excellent name. It was, of course, the season I cycle to every game. Yeah, I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, he did.
Hearing about nuts. That. So probably worth reminding people that the run to survival started after I visited the training ground. Fair enough, Stephen.
Fine, take credit for it. It wasn't Allardyce, yeah. It was Stephen. Yep.
CG 86, just Sunderland. I mean, that's a little bit negative there, CG. Fair enough. Max Power, great name. I'm never going to not make that joke. Pardew finally getting sacked and then loads of high five emojis. Fair enough. Luka and Sacco, lots of high five emojis. I mean, we'll go on to chat more about those in the last two episodes of this series as well. That run in where we took points we had no right in taking. Yep, I think we just covered that. Jamie Woods, Benteke actually scoring that season is a standout memory. What's changed since that season? I don't think we've got enough time, Jamie, to go into that. But let's just remember the good times this season. He was absolutely amazing. In that yellow shirt with the sash and in that terrible, terrible home kit, that's how I will remember him. Yeah. Any last comments, people?
Yeah, I mean, just loosely touch on the Benteke stuff. It is interesting, isn't it, to think how different things are now than they were then. It's not all down to how we play. Confidence is a huge thing. And one of the things we sort of touched on the fact that he lost a bit of form and then rediscovered it. I think that, you know, there was a period where he went away with Belgium and scored a couple of goals that kind of reinvigorated him a little bit. And it really just emphasises how much of a confidence player he is. And as you say, we'll talk more about that later. But I think overall, it was such an eventful, typical kind of Palace season that kind of initially promised a bit, you know, some exciting signings. But it really was an example of how to use the January window effectively. And how big of a change it could make. And I would just say we don't seem to have really learnt the lesson that you don't have to wait for things to be bad to use the January window in that way. You could also use it to turn a good situation into an even better one and further the club. And I still feel, you know, in the previous season, we missed an opportunity to do that. But yeah, the January window saved us. We brought in some terrific players. And yeah, overall, I think we ended this season pretty happy. But in typical Palace style, the next one started off quite troubling.
Well, people can find that out next week or whenever you're listening. I think one thing we forgot to mention was quite the impact Jonathan Benteke had.
He made
that one appearance in our first win against Middlesbrough. We got 6 points off him. Thanks for that, Middlesbrough. He came on to replace his brother, and Hesketh of the preview pod wanted me to point out that he had a shot from about 50 yards soon after he came on that, as far as I remember, tamely rolled to the goalkeeper.
Yeah, it really did.
And sadly, he never managed to find himself in the team again. So a great shame. And we will leave with beautiful memories of Jonathan Benteke. So, yeah, we will be back for episode 9 of 10 of the Palace Years. Thank you very much for continuing listening. Thank you for following us on all the socials. And if you haven't left a review on your pod platform of choice, please do, unless it's a bad one, in which case, please don't.
Five stars only.
Well, 4.5, I'll take that. So anything that you'd have as an Uber rating, I'm cool with. So, yes, until then, thanks a lot for listening, and bye.
Back of the Nest, the Palace Years.
It's the 90th minute. All your mates around. You've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Your mates already got booked for double dipping, and you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.